UK Wine Show, show number 28, Matthew Jukes. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 28 for the 13th of December. This week we're going to be talking to Matthew Jukes, wine writer for the Daily Mail, with an estimated readership of 10 million people in the UK. We're going to be talking to Matthew about his top 250 book, his Burgundy and Bordeaux reports, as well as his recommendations for Christmas. I also tease out of him some of his thoughts on Pinot Noirs from the New World. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. A wine diet may sound like an oxymoron, but a new book published this week argues the case for drinking moderate amounts of red wine every day as part of a healthy lifestyle. The Wine Diet has been written by Roger Corder, a cardiovascular expert and professor of experimental therapeutics at the William Harvey Research Institute in London. Wine drinkers are generally healthier and often live longer, Professor Corder says in his book. The reason for this, according to his research, is that procyanidins in red wine are good for us. These are a type of polyphenol, which are the main contributors to the colour and taste of red wine, but they are also found in foods such as cranberries and chocolate. Professor Corder explained that some wines are more beneficial than others. Basically, the richer they are in these molecules, the better. This depends not only on the grape variety, but also the winemaking technique. Wines that have a long fermentation and maceration with a tannic style initially, tend to be the most abundant sources. Apparently, the best example is Madiran in southwest France, because universally people there are using traditional methods with the Tannat grape variety. So the good news is, on January the 1st, you can still reach for a glass of red as part of your New Year healthy lifestyle plan. The Wine Diet is published by Little Brown and priced at £9.99. Next up, as we head into Christmas, we're probably more concerned with fizz than our figures. In a Which magazine blind tasting, the best supermarket-owned label champagnes have beaten many well-known and more expensive brands. Experts voted Sainsbury's 1799 Taste the Difference Premier Cru 2000 as top champagne, praising it for its elegance and class. It just pipped Summerfield's Prince William Premier Cru, which at $14.99 won the award for exceptional value. This bubbly was also noted for its maturity and elegance. Big name brands Lanson Black Label and Veuve Clicquot managed respectable fourth and fifth positions. However, Meurt and Chandon's Brew Imperial, which costs around £24 at Tesco, was beaten by all but two of the 16 champagnes tested and by some of the sparkling wines. The taste test of 32 bottles was carried out by consumer magazine Which using six wine experts. And finally, 2 months after the European Union finally legalised the use of oak chips in winemaking, the French have taken the decision to ban their use for Appellation Control A wines. The French regulatory body INAO believes that oak chips aren't appropriate for AOC wines. Their view is that they are likely to mask the wine's terroir and that only barrel ageing will do. However, just to confuse matters, there are exceptions to the rule. Currently, seven French appellations have been granted permission to experiment with wood chips. These include four in Bordeaux, as well as Anjou, Muscadet and Côte de Rhône. According to Elodie Pasty at the INAO, the experiments hope to answer questions about the effects oak chips have on wine, such as whether they change the deep structure and tannins, and whether a wine can be aged when oak chips are used. That's it for the news. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks for that, Jane. Quite interesting about the Wine Diet book. We're actually going to be talking to Roger next week, which we will be then releasing just after Christmas, just in time for you to think about your wine diet. Next up, we've got the interview with Matthew. Hi, I'm here with Matthew Jukes, wine writer and wine consultant. How are you, Matthew?
Not bad at all, thanks.
You've been in the trade for quite a while now. How many years have you been doing this for?
I'm in my 20th year now.
20th year, so that's right. A fairly long time.
It is, yeah.
What exactly got you into the trade?
My mum was teaching cookery way back in the 80s at Cordon Bleu School, and she invited me along. I was a starving student, so she invited me along to one of those cookery evenings. It was a wine and food matching evening. So free ticket plus a bit of booze. I thought, man, go on.
Can't go wrong.
That sounds fantastic. So I went along, and the lecturer was well known to winos out there, a chap called Robert Joseph, editor of Wine Magazine and inventor of the International Wine Challenge. And he took us through a whole lot of wines and some food and stuff like that. And at the end of it, I sat there thinking, you know, this is rather weird, but I understand all of this. And I walked up to him and said, look, I'm doing a physics degree, but I knew all the stuff you were talking about this evening. Is that a bit weird? And he said, yep, you should be in the wine trade. So the next day I cycled down to Barnes in southwest London and asked for a job at the Barnes wine shop. And I never looked back.
Really? Mm. Did you give up physics that day? Or?
I gave up physics that week. I went. I gave my tutor a letter saying, look, I'm giving up to join the wine trade. He said, that's a very good idea, Matthew. So I'll take that as a compliment, but I'm not sure it was meant that way.
Excellent. And how long have you been writing for the Daily Mail now?
I have been writing for the Mail for 7 years. So I'm well into my 300th column, plus a few bits and pieces. And it's a wicked job. It's one of the biggest red wine columns in the world. So I've got a nice big audience to muck around
with.
How
many people read it?
Well, they reckon that 3.5 million people buy it. And because the column's in the TV section, more than 3 people read each paper. So getting on for sort of 9 to 10 million.
That's a big slice of the population.
Yeah, it's massive. And they're a nice readership. They're all quite sort of into wine, into entertaining. So there's a kind of cookery column that runs alongside it, so I can do wine and food matching. But also, they're not bargain hunters as such. They use me to spend money as opposed to save money. I sort of think of them as having their allocated 20 quid a week or 10 quid a week, whatever they've got,
yep.
And I'm just telling them how to spend it.
Yeah, although my in-laws read the Daily Mail, and they're definitely at the bottom end of the...
a fiver will do. There's nothing wrong with spending a fiver.
Or 4 or 3. You write for the Daily Mail. You've also got you do the Burgundy Report?
Yeah, I have a website called MatthewJukes.com, which kind of does higher brow kind of stuff. I do an annual Burgundy Report, which I'm about to go off and compile next week.
Off to Burgundy to drink.
Yeah, just taste,
sorry.
So I drive down there and then motor around about sort of 40 properties in a week. Mm-hmm. The top people. So yeah. Everybody right the way up to Domaine Le Fleuve and Domaine de la Romanée Conti. So really scary stuff.
Yeah.
And then write about the wines themselves just in time for the en primeur offers to come out from all the wine merchants around the country. So hopefully it's a guide to my readers to tell them how to spend their money accurately.
You look at the wines, but do you look at any of the trends or the changes in the industry in the Burgundy?
Yeah, very much so. The beginning part of it is sort of a state of the nation kind of address. What's happening in Burgundy, how's it hanging kind of thing. And then about the weather and the harvest. I mean, we're lucky we've had some seriously good vintages in the last few years. So, in fact, things are just getting better. 2005, which is the ones I'm going to taste, they really have some serious potential. But of course, in tasting the 2005s out of barrel, all of the 2006s will have been harvested and will be fermenting away.
Yeah.
So I can have a little sneaky peek at those as well. And word on the street is it's not such a good vintage.
Okay.
So I can kind of nail the 2005 and give you a preview of the potential of the 2006. So each year has a double kind of angle to it. And then, yeah, get back and type that up pretty quickly. It's a huge report. It's about 40,000 words. So it's the size of a book.
And where do people get that? Is it just from the download?
Just from the website, yeah.
Download from your website.
But then that's just one of them. I do the Bordeaux. Everyone does a Bordeaux one.
Yeah.
The thing about Burgundy is very few people do it these days, but I do a Bordeaux one as well. And then each year, depending on what's on, I do a different one. So this year, South Africa, because I went down to the Cape Wine 2006. Next year, I'm doing moderating the Pinot Conference in Wellington, New Zealand. So Pinot Noirs everywhere.
Yeah.
I'll do a report on that. And then I always do my 100 best Australian wines in May.
The 100 best Australian wines, is that distributed in the UK or in Australia?
Again, that's a website-based thing, but we actually do a printed version of it as well. So we do like a brochure, like a sort of mini magazine on that, and turn that into a bit more of a kind of roadshow because everybody's seriously into Aussie wine.
Yeah.
And we launch it at Australia House in London and get a whole load of wine merchants down and other journalists down to comment on the wines. Australia is well known in the UK, it's number one in the UK, but it's well known mainly for its sort of sub-£7 wines.
Exactly.
And this report's more about what happens above that up to the sort of £40 mark, saying, you know, this is a very, very serious country at all price levels.
Yeah,
competes
sure.
on a sort of world level against even the greats from France and Italy.
Well, one of the problems I always think Australia has is that whilst it's got good diversity of range and style,
it's not really that well explained to the public.
Yeah, that's one of the key aims that I have in compiling this report. And therefore, the wines are chosen across the whole of Australia, all different price points, and also different styles. So instead of it being 70 of them being big blockbuster Shiraz styles, which is what you might expect, actually pick a few Pinot Gris and a few Viogniers and a few Sweeties and, you know, really mix it up, a few fizzy wines.
Yep.
And try to show some serious diversity, which hopefully will then be passed on to the consumer, and they can just learn more, I suppose.
One of the regions I quite liked when I went to Australia recently was Hunter Valley and their Semillons, because I'm not a big fan of big alcoholic wines at the moment. I like, yeah, they've got some nice wines around 10-11% alcohol, which is relatively low for what you consider Australian wines these days.
Yeah, I love that style of wine. I suppose in the past, Hunter Semillons have been drunk when they're quite old and when they take on a lot more kind of texture and flavour and stuff. But I went to the Hunter for a week earlier this year, and I popped up to Hunter, it's not far away from Sydney, and did a bit of taste, then popped back. And noticed that in tasting all the young wines, so I tasted all the 05s, literally all of them, they were stunning. Yeah. And not dissimilar to a sort of less tropical Sauvignon Blanc kind of feel.
Yeah.
And you're right, 8.5 up to 11%. I mean, that's fresh and crisp and beautiful lively. And
nice summer
wine. I reckon they're missing a bit of a trick there in trying to keep these wines back and release them a bit late. I think they should look at both styles. And hopefully that will put the Hunter back on the map worldwide.
That's what Mount Pleasant do, don't they? Yep. They release some of their wines quite young, and then they hold some back for various times.
Yeah, well, it's quite a strange one, but the Lovedale, which is their top, McWilliams Mount Pleasant Lovedale, is one of their top wines. In fact, I think it's the best single vineyard Semillon in the world. The reason why they released that wine young now is because of the 100 Best 3 years ago.
Oh, really?
I put one of their wines at 100 Best. Phil Ryan went nuts. The winemaker went nuts and said, you can't do that. It's a late release wine. We can't give you samples of it, you know, for the general public. They can't buy it. And I said, well, no, give me some samples and we'll see whether they want to buy it or not. And from that day onwards, they release a very small proportion of it very early.
Yeah.
And they don't keep it back for 5 years anymore, which is a great coup, really, for us young Semillon kind of fans.
But you're also a bit of a Pinot Noir man. How do you think the New World Pinots are comparing to maybe some of the Burgundies?
I think that they're getting closer. They'll never get all the way because, of course, the terroir is completely different. The vineyards are different. It's a different place. But one of the crucial things that the New World's tackling at the moment, and it's Aussies and the Kiwis, and to a lesser extent sort of Chileans, South Africans and Californians, is that they're getting the right clonal material now in the vineyards. So it's only a matter of time for these vines to age and grow and, you know, get into their teens and 20s. So there's great stuff to look forward to. Then they'll be making some wicked, wicked wines. But at the moment, it's only people who have planted the right stuff early enough who are making great wine.
What about places like Napa, where initially they were trying to copy Burgundy, and now they're really just trying to create their own style, which is obviously quite a bit richer and
fuller? Yeah, I think that way. You've just got to do what the soil gives you. There's no point trying to make something taste different, trying to copy something else. And the very greatest wines on the planet, and there's no exception to this, taste of where they're from. In fact, so just celebrate where you are. Make the best thing you can out of the grapes that your vineyards give you.
Do you think that US style, or, you know, the fuller US styles that are as good as maybe the Burgundy styles, and an enjoyment factor and all that, as opposed to maybe a critical point?
It's a difficult one. I think that they are very reflective of the American palate. American palate in most styles of wine likes a richer and, dare I say it, sweeter, but what I really mean by that is riper style of wine. And that can crawl up the ladder in alcohol and edge towards some of these big 14 to 15 stars. Now, that doesn't suit Pinot enormously. Mm-hmm. I find the wine's quite filling, quite intense. And if you've got four people for dinner, then you can chew through a few glasses, that's fine. I'd find it pretty hard to chew through a bottle of big, big Sonoma kind of Pinot Noir just through with two people. The sort of element, the character that the Burgundy wines have is they have an intensity, but perhaps not the weight and power and sheer brawn of some of the American wines, but they have lower alcohol. And they also tend to engender a lot more complexity of flavour. So you'll sip them over and enjoy them over a much longer period of time, rather than getting that initial kind of fruit rush that you get from the New World styles.
Yep. Do you think that style will age at all?
Early indications, and I've been doing this now for quite a while, is that they don't age anywhere near as long.
Yeah.
And even the winemakers who are desperately proud of their wines say, oh, it's a keep for 5 to 10 years or 15 years, 20 years, just overestimate the kind of seriousness of their wines. And it's not, they don't look like they're aging because they don't, the colour doesn't fall out like Burgundy's and they turn sort of brick red and look really, they don't really do that. They just tend to fall over. Literally, just wander along one day and a wine falls over. And, you know, 5 years old is about where it's at the moment for me. And that's not just Pinot. That is Cabernet and Merlot from the Napa, for example, as well. I think that they tend to then lose little chunks of flavour, like a great big kind of limousine driving along and the wing mirror's falling off and the number plate falling off and then the back bumper falling off. It's still a limo, you can see.
They're not just closing down for a period of time. People talk about, Cabernet Sauvignon shutting down for a period of time. You know, you lose a bit and then it comes back.
Yeah, you see that with Cabernet and you see that with Syrah, particularly Cote Rôti and Northern Rhone wines. They only do that because what they're doing is they're getting grumpy in their teens. They're getting sort of they literally are shutting up because they're going through puberty and they come out the other side. Unfortunately, I haven't seen that happen with any of the more recent North American styles of wine. I have, however, seen that with much older California wines. So some of the very early Robert Mondavi wines, some of the very early BV Georges Latour Cabernets that were made with much, much lower alcohol.
Okay.
And they were very much similar to the Clarets, old Claret styles. They were made in the 12.5%.
Yep.
And I think that they had a much higher acidity and quite perky tannins as well in the youth. And that was what kept them going. Whereas today it's all about fruit sweetness and extraction, trying to aim for that sort of Parker 100 points kind of thing. Because that's what he likes. And of course, I think that those wines are out of balance. And balance is all. Balance is the only word that really
concerns
anybody.
Out of balance anybody. When they're older because the alcohol's just left hanging out?
Out of balance
out,
from the beginning.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. So what you can see is you can see exuberance and enthusiasm on the palate, but you can't see an awful lot behind that. It's like a sort of Hollywood show. You know, it's all incredibly exciting to look at and to hear, and visually it's just incredible. But is there much depth behind it? Mm-hmm. Are we going to remember it next year? Or if we moved on to the next show, you know.
One of the things we wanted to cover on this is, because the show is being released just before Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully, is some of your picks for Christmas. That is.
Yeah, you want some picks from my book?
Yeah, if you've got something that will go down quite well.
Absolutely. Well, every year I write this book with a wine list. This is 2007. I pick out the top 250 wines on the market, on the shelves, in the UK. What do you want? Do you want a fizzy to kick off with?
Yeah, why not? Not necessarily champagne. I don't need to drink champagne, but I like a bit of fizz.
I opened a bottle of this the other day, Greenpoint Rosé. Okay. So quite rare to see the rosé over here.
I've heard of Greenpoint, but...
Yeah, cause this is made by Tony Jordan. It's a Yarra Valley-based property, but owned by Moët & Chandon, so it's got good street cred. But they make a vintage rosé, 2002 rosé. Aubin sell it for $13.99.
Okay.
And it is... I'm very fussy about rosé champagne.
Yeah.
I'm a Bill Carr salmon freak. So in order to drink rosé champagne, I normally have to spend more than £30, which is quite terrifying, and can't do that very often. So to find something that's less than half the price really is a big move for me.
Yep.
And I heartily recommend that wine. He's also sealed it with a crown cap.
Unusual.
Yeah.
I always find it quite funny. There's this whole debate about screw caps versus cork. People don't necessarily realise that... Sparkling wines spend a lot of their time under a beer cap.
Yeah, you know, they spend it under a beer cap, and when during production,
yeah,
prior to release, prior to sticking the other one that you see in the top, okay. He's decided to just keep that one on for the obvious reason that it can't be corked.
Yep.
So perfect. I mean, tons of sparkling wines are corked, and champagnes are corked, and that's just not right, really. You know, that's not how we like it.
I must admit, I've hardly ever noticed sparkling wines that are corked as opposed to, you know, reds or whites.
Yeah, well, it does happen.
Yeah.
It's all over the place. Still that 1 in 10, 1 in 12 thing that people talk about, but I see it more often than that in the course of tasting around. It's still a complete pain. It's always the bottle you don't want it to be as well. It's always that one you've been waiting, you know, saving up, and the guests are waiting, and you pull the cork and you go, oh, bloody hell, it's corked again.
That's why you should always buy by the case.
Yeah, but hang on a sec. That doesn't get rid of the problem, does it? Still means you've got a corked bottle in there.
Yeah, you've still got one in reserve, though, if it gets...
Yeah, that's true. What about a really racy bit of white wine?
Yep.
There's a great variety that people are sort of starting to get into over here called Albariño.
Oh, from Spain, Riabacus.
Yeah, absolutely right. And it's, I think probably 5 years ago, there were only three or four examples in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But now we've spotted it. and we spotted it in a big way. And there are a few that are coming over. I'll give you two. Believe it or not, it's a Sainsbury's Taste the Difference Albarino 05. Now, normally with the Sainsbury's Taste the Difference wines, you can't taste the difference, but you can with this one, I can assure you. It's a 2005 vintage, and it's only $5.99.
Yep, nice.
Now, the reason why we like that is because it is very Albarino in style, so it's got the floral, beautiful floral nose, not far from being a Viognier-esque kind of scent, but not quite as peachy and over the top. Then a Rieslingy sort of limey palate, and then a dry Sauvignon Blanc kind of finish.
Oh, nice.
But all in one move, so that's what Albarino does. So you can have it as a posh aperitif with nibbles or smoked salmon or kind of even Asian fusion kind of bargees or whatever you want. You can then move into light fishy starters. And if you're having turkey or something or cold leftovers next day...
Oh, yeah, we'll go with that.
Perfect with that.
Yeah.
And perfect little fishy work. So anything you want, really. And then the other one is another Robbins wine. It's a quid more, and it's called Val do Sossego Albarino, 2005 again. And this one's just got a bit more oomph to it.
But texturally, or...?
Yeah, texturally. A little bit oilier.
Yep.
So in that respect, you are more foodie rather than the Sainsbury's wine, which is a little bit lighter and fresher. What about a sort of light, fresh red?
Yeah, to go with your turkey.
To go with your turkey, and then a big boy to go with cheese.
Yes, sounds good.
Okay,
and
right.
Port to finish.
Port to finish, no worries. Light, fresh red, you've got to head to Waitrose. Viña Fuerte Garnacha from Calatayud in Spain. It's $4.99. They have a 2004 on the shelf at the moment. The 2005 I've tasted the other day at the press tasting is delicious as well. Garnacha's Grenache. Grenache is your lovely Cote d'Iron base grape variety. Soft, juicy, red and black fruit. Fleshy, not too heavy, but the Spanish ones tend to have a little bit of herbal kind of pipe smoky sort of aroma to them.
From being a bit lean?
No, just from the soil and from the leafiness and climate and various other things. So basically you have a plummy sort of herbal sort of juicy style of wine that costs you a fiver, but it actually tastes like sort of £7 or £8 Rioja.
Oh, nice.
But without that vanilla wood flavour.
Without any oaking.
Yeah.
So like a Jovenel.
Yeah, Jovenel. So it's just like a bit smooth and fresh. Fantastic wine. I think that my blockbuster, this one comes from Waitrose as well, but it's also sold at Bat and Bottle, Cambridge Wine Cellars, Corkscrew, S.H. Jones, Le Riche, Noble Rot, so all over the place. Got to get the book to find it. is a Portuguese wine called Tinto da Anfora, 2003.
Okay.
Now, it's made from grapes like Aragonese, which is Tempranillo. Alfrechero, I think, is in it. Trincadeira is definitely in it. So weird Portuguese varieties, and there's a bit of Cabernet dribbled in the end. So I think it's four or five varieties. It's $5.99, and I reckon it's my best value red wine of the whole year.
Really?
Yeah, fact.
Okay.
It's a big boy, spicy, dark, plummy, pruny kind of black fruit. It's got a finish on it.
Lengthwise
and
character.
And it keeps the volume up.
Yep.
It doesn't just tail off. And that's what Portugal's doing at the moment. They're making some really chunky, impressive, but cultured. And because they're using their indigenous varieties, they're flavours you don't often encounter. So actually it's quite has a different flavour.
Nice, yeah.
So it keeps
your
brain kind of excited as much as your palate. Anyway, it's called Tinta da Anfora Bacalhau 03. And the 04 is fab as well. Mainly from Waitrose, but from five or six independents around the country as well. Can I give you another Aussie red?
Yeah, if you want.
This is a wine. This is one of these ones. If you know a little bit about if you can read back labels. Labels are so underrated. Reading labels is a skill everybody has to have. But it's called Maranhanga Dam Grenache Shiraz Mourvèdre, 2004 from Marks & Spencer. It's £10, so it's more expensive. Yeah. But guess who makes it? Dave Powell at Torbrek makes this. Torbrek is one of the most expensive wines from the Barossa Valley. There was a time when the Run Rig was being sold for $1,000 a bottle in New York. This bloke makes incredibly expensive wine, Run Rig, Steading, things like that. They are up around the 50s normally.
Yep.
And he makes this wine. It's got an M&S label on it called Maranhanga Dam, so it doesn't necessarily give anything away.
Yeah.
But it's £10, and you get all of Dave's skills in that wine.
Oh, brilliant.
Port?
I know.
What about... De Bortoli's,
oh,
Majestic,
yeah.
And Obin sell this.
Yeah, sure.
For £10.
Is that from the Yarra Valley?
No, they make it from Riverina fruit.
Okay.
But it's de Bortoli Show Reserve Muscat, and it's probably about 10, 15-year-old kind of muscat in there. But it's a full bottle for 10 quid.
It's in 50.
Normally they come in half bottles or 50s.
Yep.
And so value for money-wise, this is an absolute winner. I call it the sort of wine that the Aussie rugby team trains with. They probably rub it in and drink it. It's absolutely awesome, awesome stuff. There's just one more. Can I just mention a port that I found this year
that I
thought was really, really interesting? It's a Fonseca. Hell of a property, Fonseca. One of the great, great properties. But they've made an organically grown port. And sometimes people kind of don't associate organics with port production.
No.
And it's called Terra Prima, non-vintage. It's a bit like a sort of LBV kind of feel in its taste, but it's only 11 quid. There's only two places in England that sell it, Amps and Oundle and Rayburn up in Edinburgh. But well worth finding, phoning them up and tracking them down. 11 quid for what really is one of the great ideas, and also then it's always great to have an idea in the wine world, but to carry it through and make it look good. This wine tastes so, so good, so pure and so long and cultured. The sort of wine that you can sit on the telly watching Raiders of the Lost Ark for the umpteenth time. There you go. And, and that's only what we've got through seven or something. There's another 243 to go. But
book. Excellent, excellent. Has it been released, the 2007?
Yeah, book? It's been on the shelves for a few weeks. I'm lucky to say it's been a bestseller every year.
Yep.
6 years in a row, so that's quite nice. You don't count your chickens until you see the figures at the end of Christmas, but we're very pleased with it. And I think one of the main reasons it sells, not just the 250, because that's a hell of a lot of work, and that's me tasting 35,000 wines a year and whittling down to 250, is the food and wine chapter. Again, it comes back to this food and wine theme that I have throughout my life with my restaurant consultancy and all this sort of stuff, that food and wine matching is key, and there's a huge food and wine matching chapter in there, and that's what people use a lot when before they go out shopping to find the wines.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's nice. And in the back of it, I know I mentioned a load of wine merchants just then, but there's the totally comprehensive directory of all the wine merchants in the UK. So you can find out, if you live in the middle of nowhere, you can find out who's closest to you. And if you live out there, it's also, if you live out there, you can also figure out who what the sort of hotlines for all the big supermarkets are, and see if they deliver and stuff like that.
Because a lot of them deliver now.
A lot of them deliver now. In fact, I don't really have anybody in the directory who doesn't deliver worldwide. Nationwide, I mean. That's nice. All you need to know.
Excellent, excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much, Matthew.
It's my pleasure.
Cheers very much.
See you, dude.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Matthew. Quite a nice fella. He's definitely got some wines I'll be trying out in the next couple of weeks. On the show notes, I've got a list of all the wines that he's recommended and where you can source them from, as well as he talked about clones in the interview at one point, so there's a technical description on what a clone is. Next week, we're going to be talking to Rod Smith from Taylor's. Taylor's, obviously, big port people, but Rod's going to be giving us some tips and tricks on how to get the most out of your port. Until then, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff to Jingle One by Marcel de la Jatelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.